Okay, let's unpack this. International investing, it sounds great, right? Growth opportunities outside your home turf. But honestly, it can feel like wading through treacle sometimes, especially with all the regulations. You need access, sure, but you also need it to be safe, legal, compliant.
Absolutely. And that's where things can get complicated fast.
So our mission in this deep dive is to really clarify one of the main structures for that, the portfolio investment scheme, or PIS. We want to make it less, intimidating.
Exactly. Think of it as the official gateway. It's the regulated, transparent way non-residents, foreign investors, can actually buy and sell stocks, listed securities, in another country's market, legally.
And this isn't just some niche thing, is it?
Not at all. While the term PIS itself might be specific, you see it quite a bit across Asia, and it's definitely a big deal in the Gulf, the MENA region.
Yeah.
But the underlying idea, that's global. Any country that wants foreign investment but also wants to keep a handle on things uses some version of this blueprint. So our goal today is really to give you that solid foundation. What is PIS? Why is it even there? And importantly, how can you use it smartly as part of a bigger diversified strategy looking ahead to, say, 2026?
Right. So let's start right there. Why? If I, as a foreign investor, can often just open an online brokerage account, why the need for this, well, seemingly heavy-duty PIS framework? Why doesn't the broker just sort it all out?
That's a great question. It comes down to the fact that non-resident market participation isn't just about clicking buy. It touches on national rules, legal checks, due diligence. PIS is that formal regulatory layer. It basically says, okay, foreign investor, you're welcome, but here are the rules. It ensures every single trade you make fits within local laws, things like how you take money out, taxes, and this is crucial, limits on foreign ownership.
Ownership limits. That's a big one.
It is, and PIS is designed to manage that. It's this structure that has to balance two sort of competing things.
Competing how?
Well, on one hand, the host country wants foreign money. They want investors like you bringing capital in, accessing their growth.
Makes sense.
But on the other hand, they need to maintain control. And this isn't just bureaucracy for its own sake, it's about stability. It lets them protect key industries, stop sudden capital flight, and enforce those rules about how much of a local company foreigners can actually own.
So it's a controlled valve in a way.
Precisely. Without something like PIS, managing that flow in a legal, orderly way would be, well, nearly impossible.
Oh, okay. So that tension explains why these schemes exist. And you mentioned they're common in specific places.
Yeah, you see them a lot in emerging markets. They're hungry for foreign capital, right? For infrastructure, for growth. But they're also protective of new or strategic industries. PIS lets them have both, with guardrails.
Yeah, in the Gulf.
In the Gulf region, you often see schemes tailored even further. Sometimes they include features to help investors stick to Sharia-compliant principles while still participating internationally and supporting the local economy. It's quite integrated.
So, for you, the listener, PIS is really that legal bedrock. It takes cross-border investing from something potentially murky to something structured, lawful, manageable, good for the investor looking for growth. Good for the country wanting regulated capital.
Exactly.
All right, so we've covered the why. Let's get practical. The how. If it's all about compliance and control, how does this regulation actually get enforced day to day? Because, like you said, relying just on a broker seems risky for the host country if they're worried about limits.
It absolutely is, which is why the whole system hinges on the banks. It's managed entirely through regulated specific bank accounts. The bank acts as the legally required gatekeeper. That's what gives PIS its teeth.
A specific bank account.
Yes. As the investor, your first step is opening a PIS account, but it has to be with an accredited bank, one that's specifically approved under that country's PIS rules. This isn't just any bank account, it's your mandatory financial gateway for these investments.
Okay, so I still pick my stocks through my broker, presumably.
You do. You work with your licensed broker for the investment decisions. But the bank is the crucial checkpoint. Does that add a layer? Yes. Does it slow things down slightly compared to a purely domestic trade? Maybe.
How does that work then, the actual flow?
You tell your broker, buy X shares. The order goes to market. But the key part there, the settlement, the money movement, the compliance check, that all gets routed through your designated PIS bank account. The bank's main job there is twofold. One, record everything for the regulators. Two, and this is vital, check compliance before the trade fully settles. They check against those ownership limits, sector restrictions, everything.
So if a trade would push me over a limit?
The bank stops it, exactly, before it happens. And when you sell or get dividends, the money only lands in your account after the bank runs those same checks.
That's a fundamental difference from just trading domestically, where it feels much more direct. What kind of assets can you usually trade through PIS? Is it everything?
Generally, no. It's usually focused on listed equities, so stocks traded on the main exchanges and often exchange-traded funds, ETFs. Sometimes certain types of convertible bonds or debentures might be allowed if they meet the rules, but things like complex derivatives or unlisted private shares, usually they're out.
Okay, let's try and make this really concrete. Let's use that example you mentioned. Say I'm based in Saudi Arabia and I want to use PIS to buy shares in, I don't know, a tech company listed in Singapore. How does that look step by step?
Right. So first, you need that PIS account with an approved bank funded. Let's say you put in maybe 5,000 Saudi rials, 5,000 SAR, ready to go. You then instruct your broker to buy the shares in the Singaporean tech company. The order executes on the Singapore exchange. But the money transfer, the currency conversion from SAR, the final purchase settlement that all flows through, and is recorded by your designated PIS bank. Mm-hmm. Then later, if you sell those shares, maybe for a profit, the process reverses. The sale proceeds come back through the PIS account, currency converts back if needed, and the bank documents everything again. That full loop, fully documented by the bank, is the essence of PIS in action. Transparency is built in.
Got it. That documentation must be a huge plus.
It really is. When you think about the benefits for the investor, that regulatory peace of mind is probably number one. The bank is handling the heavy lifting on compliance checks for local rules, which reduces your personal risk significantly.
And you mentioned taxes earlier. That detailed record keeping must help there too.
Massively. Every buy, every sell, every dividend, every capital gain, it's all logged automatically by the bank within the PIS system. Mm-hmm. This makes tracking your performance much easier, and yes, preparing those cross-border tax returns becomes, well, less of a nightmare. Ultimately, PIS unlocks access to potentially high-growth markets you might otherwise be locked out of.
Okay, access is great, but it comes with strings attached. Let's talk compliance must-knows. If someone's listening and thinking about this, what are the absolute key rules they need on their checklist to avoid problems?
Yeah, good question. We can probably boil it down to four main areas. Mm-hmm. First up, eligibility. Who can actually use PIS?
Right.
Usually it's for non-resident individuals, maybe NRIs, OCIs, depending on the country, or approved foreign institutions. You'll absolutely need proof of your overseas residency or whatever investor accreditation is required. That's non-negotiable.
Okay, eligibility first. What's second?
Second is the account setup itself. As we discussed, everything has to go through that one designated PIS bank account, working with an approved bank or broker. No side deals, no using other accounts, all trades, in and out, must flow through this specific channel.
Makes sense. And the third area, this feels like where the state control aspect really shows up.
Yes, number three, investment limits and caps. This is absolutely critical. Countries often set limits on the total percentage of a company that can be owned by all foreign PIS investors combined, say maybe only 49% of a big telecom company. They might also have limits per specific stock or even entire sector restrictions. These caps are there to protect strategic assets or maintain domestic control. And if your trade would breach one of these caps, blocked by the bank instantly.
And those caps must affect how the market works too, right? Not just individual trades.
They certainly can. They impact liquidity. If a popular stock is already near its foreign ownership limit, there are fewer shares available for other PIS investors to buy. This can sometimes push up the price or just make it hard to get your order filled. Which leads nicely into the fourth category,
which is
prohibited investments. Some sectors might just be completely off limits. Think sensitive areas like defense, maybe certain media companies or key natural resources. The government might decide these are too strategic for any foreign PIS ownership. You just can't legally invest there through this scheme.
Okay. Eligibility, account setup, limits, prohibited sectors, and the final piece, always lurking, taxes.
Always. It's the final layer, tax considerations. Now, the bank manages the PIS compliance, but the tax liability, that's still yours. You absolutely need to understand the rules on capital gains tax in that country, any dividend withholding tax, and crucially, the rules around repatriation, how and when you can legally take your profits back home. These rules vary a lot by jurisdiction.
So PIS gives you this regulated pathway, primarily for equities, long-term growth. But equity markets, as we know, go up and down, sometimes wildly. How does an investor use PIS but still manage that inherent risk?
That's the key strategic question. PIS provides the structure for accessing equities, yes, but equities are just one asset class, and they can be volatile, sensitive to everything from geopolitics to interest rates to sudden regulatory shifts. So relying solely on PIS equities is risky. Smart investing means diversification. You need other assets in the mix, ideally things that don't move in lockstep with the stock market, non-correlated assets.
Okay, so how do you bring in that stability, that non-correlated element, alongside PIS?
Well, one common approach, and something highlighted in the materials we looked at, is using property-backed investments. Think platforms like Gamma Assets was mentioned as an example. The strategic advantage here is resilience.
Resilience how?
Okay, so your PIS equity portfolio, its value bounces around based on market sentiment, future earnings guesses, you know, perception. Property-backed investments, though, are tied to tangible real-world assets, bricks and mortar. Their returns usually come from things like rental income or the underlying property value increasing. These tend to operate on a different economic cycle than stocks.
Right. So if the stock market tanks because, say, the Fed hikes rates unexpectedly, the income from your rented out commercial property isn't likely to vanish overnight. It provides a buffer.
Exactly that. That's the strategic blend. You might find property-backed opportunities, sometimes accessible for relatively small amounts, maybe like that 500 SAR figure mentioned, that offer steady income and stability. This helps smooth out the inevitable bumps you'll experience with your PIS equity holdings.
So the overall strategy becomes clearer. Use PIS for that regulated access to international stocks, aiming for growth, especially in maybe emerging markets. But crucially, balance that by allocating some capital to more stable asset-backed options like property for steady returns and resilience.
That's smart portfolio construction in action. PIS is your compliant gateway to potentially high-growth markets. But pairing it with stable, tangible assets helps protect your capital and grow it more consistently over the long haul. It means your financial journey isn't entirely dependent on the whims of the stock market.
Okay, so what does this all mean for you, listening in? PIS isn't just another trading account with extra steps. It's really the fundamental regulated structure you need for accessing international equities legally and aiming for long-term compliant growth. That mandatory bank oversight is what makes it different, turning a potentially complex international venture into something more predictable.
Exactly. But maybe here's a final thought to chew on. Building on that oversight, we've talked about how PIS facilitates growth, but also how it restricts those sector limits and those ownership caps. These rules fundamentally shape who can buy what and how much. Given that a host country deliberately limits the foreign capital flowing into certain areas, what are the unseen ripples? How might those very necessary compliance features subtly influence the overall liquidity, or maybe even the long-term valuations of those foreign-held assets within that specific market? Understanding that dynamic, both the access and the constraint, that's probably key for planning your next move.